North and South Carolina, Georgia, and parts of Wood. The present inhabitants of those states, living on formerly Cherokee lands, accept being called thieves, as Rabbi Avner calls the Palestinians. Would they agree to be transferred out, in order to make room for returning Cherokees? How would they respond, if the Cherokees adopted the Likud policy of making their lives so miserable they would want to leave? Would they agree, that the Cherokees were simply liberating the injustice being done in the case of the Palestinians is compounded? The whites did steal the land, the Palestinians are innocent. It would be a great boon to some of the oppressed of mankind, if the Likud scholars would deign to explain and define this right of the historically dispossessed. It may be, given the opportunity, that the Australian Aborigines, who have a history and prehistory going back 40,000 years, would prefer the climate of Sydney to the outback. The Irish people, north and south, had lived on their lands for thousands of years. Beginning with Elizabeth I of England, and extending through Cromwell's misrule, the Irish of the north were driven from their lands at the point of the sword to a rocky barren windswept county in Western Ireland, Connaught. The British battle cry to the Irish was "to hell or Connaught." The Irish mistakenly thought they were being given a choice the British gave them both for four centuries. The British used the confiscated land of Ulster, North Ireland, to settle colonies of alien Scotch Presbyterians, who became the ruling class of Northern Ireland, while the real Irish were forced into living a subclass marginal existence, where they were persecuted religiously, economically, and politically, a situation which persists to this day. The Northern Ireland problem is not, despite common belief, a religious one. It is a civil right issue almost as bad as the blacks in South Africa and much like the Palestinians. The Southern Irish, however, were not banished to Connaught, but were simply dispossessed of their lands and made serfs. Serfs, of course, were necessary to work the large new estates being set up in Ireland by the British gentry and the land confiscators. Do the Irish have a historic right to their ancient lands? Of course, the Cherokees and the Irish are only two small peoples among what must be hundreds of millions of dispossessed and resettled populations all over the world, since the year 700 BC, the last time the Israelites lived in what became Samaria. What is puzzling about all this is that, in a world full of lawyers, the Likud can, without challenge, conjure up something called a historic right which is recognized by no code of law or system of justice from the Murabi to the Charter of the United Nations, and is not part of any body of jurisprudence anywhere. If the historic right claim were pleaded in any cause in any court or tribunal, national or international, it would be summarily dismissed, on motion, as frivolous. Yet it commands the enforced attention of the governments of the world, and rights are invented ad hoc by the Likud government without reason or rationale, heedless of the consequences to the lives of millions of unfortunate people clinging to a small piece of land, home to their ancestors, in mortal fear of being driven out. Historic right is a mischievous, as well as meaningless, claim. It fires the passions of the Israeli settlers on the West Bank, where little Jewish boys, fresh from Minsk, tell little Palestinian boys, whose families have lived there for centuries, to get out of our Jewish land. Finally, Israel should be aware that both the divine right claim and the historic right claim are hazardous, and can have serious political ramifications, because they effectively rip the lid off Pandora's box, as Flappin calls it, and bring into question the very bona fides of the foundation of Israel itself. Earlier in this chapter, the view was expressed that any rights to the West Bank and Gaza, which may have existed 3,000 years ago, and were not abandoned or negated since, were forfeited when Israel accepted the UN partition plan in 1947. However, that is by no means the whole story. It is important to read what Zimmer Flappin has to say on this point in his book, The Birth of Israel, Myths and Realities. Israel's legendary willingness to compromise and sacrifice with regard to the scope of the Jewish state was the foundation on which its entire mythology was built during the crucial period of the UN deliberations in 1947 and 1948. The myth was invoked by all of Israel's representatives Moshe Sherrett, Abayaban, Eliyahu, Elliot, Epstein, Gideon Raphael, and Michael Comey in their conversations with UN delegates, foreign ministers, and foreign diplomats. Typical was the argument made by Sherrett, who was Israel's first foreign minister and second prime minister, to the UN Palestine Commission on January 15, 1948. Emphasis supplied, Sherrett is quoted as saying, "The Jewish people, as represented by the Jewish Agency, have declared themselves willing to cooperate in the implementation of the compromise solution, partition, because they made an effort to approach the problem in a realistic spirit, to understand and admit the legitimate rights and interests of the other section of the population of Palestine, namely, the Arabs of Palestine." Emphasis supplied, Flappin continues, Israel's ostensible acceptance of the resolution remained its most impotent propaganda weapon, even as it violated one section of that document after another. Today, with Israel controlling the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and southern Lebanon, the myth lingers on, ingrained in Israel's national consciousness, and in its schoolbooks. Yet throughout the 100-year history of the Zionist movement and the Yishuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, the vision of the great majority was always one of a homogeneous Jewish state in the whole, or at least in the greater part of Palestine. Emphasis supplied, what Flappin says in his thesis is, that the representatives of the Jewish Agency to the United Nations, during its deliberations on creating the State of Israel, deceived the UN delegates, foreign ministers and foreign diplomats as to Israel's future territorial intentions, after it acquired statehood, in order to get the necessary votes of the delegates, to establish a Jewish state. Thus, not only did the Jewish Agency representatives at the UN fail to raise any claim of right, divine, or historic, to the portion of Palestine allocated to the Palestinians in the partition, but they made positive disclaimers of such a right. Had the truth been brought out, when truth was called for, Israel would never have come into existence. The UN would never have countenanced a claim to all of Palestine, or an intent by Israel to absorb all of it. Simcha Flappin died on April 13, 1987, as his book went to press. The final two paragraphs of the book stand as a fitting last testament. At the same time, it must be recognized that the support of the Israeli peace camp for Palestinian self-determination, mutual recognition, and coexistence is not enough. Diasporagerian friends of Israel abroad must realize that present Israeli policy is doomed to reproduce over and over again the cycle of violence that shocks our sensibilities every time we read or hear of wanton murder and bloodshed, whether the hand that perpetrates it detonates a bomb or fires a pistol. The collective revenge of an army is no more righteous or admirable than the individual revenge of a desperate youth for the murder of one of his people. It is only propaganda and distorted vision that labels one terrorism and the other national defense. It is, then, in the hope of clarifying the distorted vision on our side of the conflict, that is, on the Jewish-Israeli side, that I have written this book. Emphasis supplied, Chapter 13, Israel's Dilemma, as a consequence of the liquid policies over the past 13 years, Israel finds itself in a position where it seems that whatever course is followed, it will lead either to failure or disaster. It is a multi-horned dilemma. These are the apparent alternatives. 1. If Israel attempts to maintain the status quo, it will continue to have more than 2 million enemies within its jurisdiction, including the Israeli Arabs, and the Palestinian uprising will eventually escalate into a guerrilla war too. If it annexes the West Bank and Gaza into Israel proper, the Palestinians will, in the not too distant future, outnumber the Jewish population, and it will no longer be a Jewish state. 3. If Israel withdraws from the West Bank and Gaza, and permits a Palestinian state to come into existence, it is concerned that its boundaries will be indefensible, and that it will eventually be vulnerable to attack from the Palestinian state and neighboring Arab nations. 4. If it expels the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza, Huckabee fears an all-out war in which Israel will still have 500,000 Israeli Palestinians within its borders as enemies, and face a coalition of Arab and Muslim countries from Mauritania to Indonesia. 5. Finally, it can continue its military occupation of the territories under martial law and harass, brutalize and kill the Palestinians in the hope that they will find life to be so intolerable that they will be forced to abandon their homes and leave Palestine. This is the Israeli policy currently being pursued by the Likud government.